This program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Welcome. I'm Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues, bringing you information from respected sources about health matters that may be helpful for you or those you care about in consultation with your healthcare provider. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from a variety of sources that I'll identify as we go along. Every now and then, I like to offer something that's really on the leading edge in medical research, something to give hope for people who may be afflicted by a particular illness or for those who love them. This article is about Huntington's disease being treated successfully for the first time in the UK in a gene therapy trial. It's about a study that was done in the UK and the US, and this article was published in The Guardian in late September. Huntington's disease, a devastating degenerative illness that runs in families, has been treated successfully for the first time in a breakthrough gene therapy trial. The disease, caused by a single gene defect, steadily kills brain cells, leading to dementia, paralysis, and ultimately death. Those who have a parent with Huntington's have a 50% chance of developing the disease, which until now has been incurable. The gene therapy slowed the progress of the disease by 75% in patients after 3 years. Professor Sarah Tabrizi, the director of the University College London's Huntington's Disease Center, who led the trial, said, "We now have a treatment for one of the world's most terrible diseases. This is absolutely huge. I'm really overjoyed." The drug, which inactivates the mutant protein that causes Huntington's, is delivered to the brain in a single shot during a 12 to 20 hour surgical procedure, meaning that it will be expensive. The breakthrough is sending ripples of hope through the Huntington's community, many of whom have witnessed the brutal impact of the disease on family members. The first symptoms, which typically appear when the affected person is in their 30s or 40s, include mood swings, anger, and depression. Later patients develop uncontrolled jerky movements, dementia, and ultimately paralysis, with some people dying within a decade of diagnosis. With treatment, people would be able to work and live independently for significantly longer, Tabrizi says, and the dramatic impact of the therapy raises the possibility that it can prevent symptoms occurring if given at an earlier stage. It is estimated there are between 6,000 to 10,000 people with Huntington's disease in the UK, and at least another 20,000 who are carriers of the faulty gene, meaning they are likely to develop it. However, only about one-fifth of those families affected by Huntington's choose to test for the gene because current treatments only help with symptoms rather than slowing the disease's relentless progression. Now I think many more people will come forward for the genetic test because there's a treatment, said Tabrizi. Robin Perry, 34, has been a carer to her father who has Huntington's for the past 16 years and tested positive herself at the age of 20 at a time when she was juggling study with caring responsibilities. Her father's diagnosis had a domino effect on her wider family, she said, with some learning they were also carriers of the Huntington's disease. It was so hard, she said. At the time, there was no positivity. Perry, a support worker from Liverpool, now has mild motor symptoms and hopes she may benefit from gene therapy in the future, saying that she and friends in the Huntington's community shared tears of joy on learning of the trial results. "We fought for so long for a cure," she said. "For this day to come, it means absolutely everything for us and our families." The mutant Huntington's gene contains instructions for cells to make a toxic version of a brain protein called Huntington. The therapy is delivered via a harmless virus that has been modified to deliver a specifically designed strand of DNA into neurons. To avoid adverse reactions, the virus is infused very slowly through a microcatheter into two separate brain regions, a complex procedure that takes 12 to 20 hours. Once the DNA is delivered into the neurons, it instructs the cells to block the production of the toxic version of Huntington. Results from the trial, including 29 patients treated in the UK and US, have been released by the company uniQure, although the full details are yet to be published. 3 years after treatment, those on the high dose of the drug had an average of 75% slowing of the progression of the disease based on tests of motor function, cognition, and the patient's experience of day-to-day life. There were also clear indicators in the brain that the neurons were being spared, with levels of neurofilaments, a sign of cell death, being significantly lower in the treatment group. "We are incredibly excited about these top-line results and what they may represent for individuals and families affected by Huntington's disease," said Walib Abisad, the chief medical officer of uniQure, adding that the company hoped to submit the drug for approval in the U.S. early next year. So I want to caution, as always, that this is very, very new research and has yet to be verified. But Huntington's disease can be absolutely devastating for families as well as the patient. I know from friends who've been caregivers for people with Huntington's. So I did want to share that piece of good news. This next article is from Real Clear Science, and it's entitled, "A Red Meat Allergy from Tick Bites is Rapidly Spreading." This is by Lee Ruffus-Haynes, who's an assistant research professor of molecular parasitology and medical entomology at the University of Notre Dame. I do want to note that there's a map that was included in this article, and it shows that central North Carolina is one of the highest incidence areas for this particular allergy. Hours after savoring that perfectly grilled steak on a beautiful evening, could be a nice fall evening like we have here, your body turns traitor, declaring war on the very meal you just enjoyed. You begin to feel excruciating itchiness, pain, or even swelling. Then it can escalate to the point of requiring emergency care. The culprit isn't food poisoning. It's the fallout from a tick bite you may have gotten months earlier and didn't even notice. So, what is this syndrome? Alpha-gal syndrome is actually an allergy to a sugar molecule with a tongue-twisting name, galactose alpha 1,3 galactose, shortened to alpha-gal. The alpha-gal sugar molecule exists in the tissues of most mammals, including cows, pigs, deer, and rabbits, but it's absent in humans. When a big dose of alpha-gal gets into your bloodstream through a tick bite, it can send your immune system into overdrive to generate antibodies against alpha-gal. In later exposure to foods containing alpha-gal, your immune system might then launch an inappropriate allergic response. Often this allergy is triggered by eating red meat. But the allergy can also be set off by exposure to a range of other animal-based products, including dairy products, gelatin, think Jell-O or gummy bears, medications, and even some personal care items. The drug heparin, used to prevent blood clotting during surgery, is extracted from pig intestines, and its use has triggered a dangerous reaction in some people with alpha-gal syndrome. Once you have alpha-gal syndrome, it's possible to get over the allergy if you can modify your diet enough to avoid triggering another reaction for a few years and also avoid more tick bites. But that takes time and careful attention to the less obvious triggers that you might be exposed to. So, why are more people being diagnosed? As an entomologist who studies bugs and diseases they transmit, what I find alarming is how rapidly the allergy is spreading around the globe. Several years ago, experts thought alpha-gal syndrome was primarily limited to the southeastern United States because it was largely associated with the geographical range of the Lone Star tick. However, both local and global reports have now identified many different tick species across six continents that are capable of causing alpha-gal syndrome, including the prolific black-leg tick or deer tick, which also transmits Lyme disease. These ticks lurk in yards and urban parks, as well as forests, where they can stealthily grab onto hikers when they touch tick-infested vegetation. As tick populations boom with growing deer and human populations, the number of people with alpha-gal syndrome is escalating. So, why are ticks blamed for alpha-gal syndrome? There are a few theories on how a tick bite triggers alpha-gal syndrome and why only a small proportion of people bitten develop the allergy. To understand the theories, it helps to understand what happens as a tick starts feeding on you. When a tick finds you, it typically looks for a warm, dark area to hide and attach itself to its body. Then its serrated teeth chew through your skin with rapid sawing motions. Warning, this part gets a little gross. As it excavates deeper into your skin, the tick deploys a barbed feeding tube, like a miniature drilling rig, and it secretes a biological cement that anchors its head into its new tunnel. Once secure, the tick activates its pumping station, injecting copious amounts of saliva containing anesthetics, blood thinners, and sometimes alpha-gal sugars into the wound so it can feed undetected, sometimes for days. One theory about how a tick bite causes alpha-gal syndrome is linked to the enormous quantity of tick saliva released during feeding, which activates the body's strong immune response. Another suggests how the skin is damaged as the tick feeds and the possible effect of the tick's regurgitated stomach contents into the bite site are to blame. Or it may be a combination of these and other triggers. Scientists are still investigating the causes. So, what does an allergic reaction feel like? The allergy doesn't begin right away. Typically, 1 to 3 months after the sensitizing tick bite, a person with alpha-gal syndrome has their first disturbing reaction. Alpha-gal syndrome produces symptoms that range from hives or swelling to crushing abdominal pain, violent nausea, or even life-threatening anaphylactic shock. The symptoms usually start 2 to 6 hours after a person has ingested a meat product containing alpha-gal. Due to a general lack of awareness about the allergy, however, doctors can easily miss the diagnosis. A study in 2022 found that 42% of U.S. healthcare practitioners had never heard of alpha-gal syndrome. A decade ago, people with alpha-gal syndrome might go years before the cause of their symptoms was accurately diagnosed. Today, the diagnosis is faster in areas where doctors are familiar with the syndrome, but in many parts of the country, it can still take time and multiple doctor visits. Unfortunately, with every additional tick bite or exposure to food or products containing alpha-gal, the allergy can increase in severity. If you suspect you have alpha-gal syndrome, the first step is to discuss the possibility with your doctor and ask them to order a simple blood test to measure whether your immune system is reacting to alpha-gal. If you test positive, the main strategy for managing the allergy is to avoid eating any food product from a mammal, including milk and cheese, as well as other potential triggers, such as more tick bites. Read labels carefully. Some products contain additives such as carrageenan, which is derived from red algae and contains alpha-gal. In extreme cases, people with alpha-gal syndrome may need to carry an EpiPen to prevent anaphylactic shock. Reputable websites such as the CDC and alphagalinformation.org can provide more information and advice. So there are some mysteries that remain since alpha-gal syndrome was first formally documented in the early 2000s. Scientists have made progress in understanding this puzzling condition. Researchers have connected the allergy to specific tick bites and found that people with the allergy can have a higher risk of heart disease, even without allergy symptoms. But important mysteries remain. Scientists are still figuring out exactly how the tick bite tricks the immune system and why ticks alive as a trigger for only some people. With growing public interest in alpha-gal syndrome, the next decade could bring ground breakthroughs in preventing, diagnosing, and treating the condition. For now, the next time you are strolling in the woods or in long grasses, remember to check for ticks on your body. Wear long sleeves, long pants, and tick repellent to protect yourself from these bloodthirsty hitchhikers. If you do get bitten by a tick, watch out for odd allergic symptoms to appear a few hours after your next steak or handful of gummy bears. I'm going to be adding a new feature to Health Issues. Once a month, I'll be talking about a medical mystery. Often those will come from the New York Times, but this one happens to come from Ars Technica. It's entitled, Man Gets Drunk, Wakes Up with a Medical Mystery That Nearly Kills Him. And it's written by Beth Mole, who's their senior health reporter, and who has a PhD in microbiology from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She writes, a 36-year-old man showed up to the emergency department of the Massachusetts General Hospital, severely unwell from a puzzling set of conditions. He had abnormalities in his lungs, intestines, blood, liver, and lymphatic system. And, of course, no single clear explanation. His case was such a riddle that a master clinician with expertise in clinical reasoning was called in to help unravel it. In a case report published in the New England Journal of Medicine, the expert and the man's other doctors lay out the masterful medical deduction that explained his remarkable case, which had an entirely unremarkable cause. It started about 2 weeks before his hospital visit. A mild, dull pain had developed in the patient's lower right abdomen and back. 9 days later, a fever and body aches also developed. The next day, he went to urgent care, where clinicians gave him intravenous fluids and an intravenous pain reliever. His abdominal pain went away, and he was discharged. But the pain returned over the next few days, and with it came nausea and vomiting. He then started coughing and having trouble breathing. The day before his hospital visit, he went back to urgent care. He now looked unwell, and his eyes were yellowing, his heart was racing, and his blood pressure was worryingly low, as was his oxygen saturation at just 85%. Clinicians could hear crackling in his lungs, and his abdomen was more tender than ever. They sent him to the emergency department. There, doctors confirmed what the urgent care had found, noting that he was also coughing up tan mucus. They also looked at his medical history, which is relatively short. He was born in Central America, but he had lived in the U.S. for 16 years. He worked in construction, lived in a Boston suburb with his partner and two children, and didn't seem to have any medical problems except a history of alcohol use disorder. He typically drank 4 to 5 beers a night during the week and up to a dozen a day during the weekends, though he said he hadn't been drinking during his illness. Blood and urine tests found his platelet levels were extremely low, and there were signs of liver disease. Chest imaging showed haziness in his lungs, suggesting inflammation and infection. Computed tomography or CT scans confirmed the lung findings, but also showed an enlarged liver, thickened bile duct, multiple swollen lymph nodes, a contracted gallbladder, and a blood clot in the vein from his right kidney. On closer inspection, there also seemed to be a bridge of soft tissue spanning his duodenum, the first part of the small intestine, and the right kidney. More lab results then came back showing bacteria growing in his blood. The doctors admitted him to the hospital, started him on intravenous antibiotics, and transfused him with platelets. Magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, confirmed the blood clot and the odd soft tissue bridge. In his first hospital day, the lab identified the bacteria in his blood as Streptococcus anginosus, a bacterium that typically colonizes the upper respiratory tract but can cause infections when the opportunity arises, such as when there is an injury in the gastrointestinal tract. This is where the master clinician Gurpreet Dhaliwal of the University of California, San Francisco came in. Dhaliwal could not identify a single diagnosis that could convincingly explain all of the problems at once. So he reasoned out a causal pathway, a sequence of events that could explain it all. He started with the most obvious part of the pathway. The man had developed sepsis, which tied the man's blood and liver findings with the identification of the bacteria in his blood. Because Streptococcus anginosus is linked to injuries in the gastrointestinal tract, he next turned to the strange soft tissue bridge between the duodenum and the right kidney. The duodenum was thickened, suggesting an injury or perforation, and the soft tissue bridge between that part of the intestine and the right kidney could have harbored the bacteria. An infection and inflammation there could also explain the clot. But what caused the duodenum injury to begin with? And what about the lungs? A number of things could explain the problems in his lungs, including infections from soil bacteria he might encounter in his construction work, or a parasitic infection found in Central America. But the cause that best fit was common pneumonia, and more specifically, based on the distribution of opacities in his lung, pneumonia caused by aspiration, inhaling food particles, or other things that are not air, which is something that can happen when people drink excessive amounts of alcohol, as the man regularly did. Ethanol impairs consciousness and blunts protective reflexes such as cough and gag, which disrupts the normal control mechanisms of the upper aerodigestive tract, Dhaliwal noted. And this is where Dhaliwal made a critical connection. If the man's drinking led him to develop aspiration pneumonia, accidentally getting food in his lungs, he may also have accidentally gotten non-food in his gastrointestinal tract at the same time. The things people most commonly swallow by accident include coins, button batteries, jewelry, and small bones. But these things tend to show up in imaging, and none of the imaging revealed a swallowed object. Things that don't show up in images, though, are things made of plants. This reasoning leads to the search for an organic object that might be ingested while eating and drinking, and is seemingly harmless, but becomes invasive upon entering the gastrointestinal tract, Dhaliwal wrote. The leading suspect, he concluded, is a wooden toothpick, an object commonly found in club sandwiches and used for dental hygiene. Toothpick ingestions often go unnoticed, but once identified, they are considered medical emergencies owing to their propensity to cause visceral perforation and vascular injury. If a toothpick had pierced the man's duodenum, it would completely explain all of the man's symptoms. He drank too much and lost control of his aerodigestive tract, leading to aspiration that caused pneumonia, and then he swallowed a toothpick, which perforated the duodenum and led to sepsis. Dhaliwal recommended an endoscopic procedure to look for a toothpick in his intestines. On the man's third day in the hospital, he had the procedure, and sure enough, there was a toothpick piercing through his duodenum and into his right kidney, just as Dhaliwal had predicted. Doctors promptly removed it and treated the man with antibiotics. He went on to make a full recovery. At a 9-month follow-up, he continued to do well and had maintained abstinence from alcohol. I just love a good detective story, even more so when it's a medical mystery. Quickly, I want to talk about a new COVID variant that is spreading in North Carolina. This comes from the Charlotte Observer on October 3rd. A new COVID-19 variant has quickly emerged as dominant in a matter of months, according to data from the CDC. XFG, an Omicron subvariant, also known as Stratus, has been detected in 38 countries and is spreading rapidly, according to the CDC. Has a new variant reached North Carolina? Most likely. By late August, the CDC estimated XFG made up at least as much as 78% of total cases in the U.S. For comparison, the new variant made up just 14% of total cases 2 months ago. Dr. David Weber, an infectious disease specialist at the UNC School of Medicine, told the Charlotte Observer last month that there could be a small bump in cases with students across the state returning to school. Data from the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services show that there was a steady increase in emergency department visits due to COVID-like symptoms every week from August 2nd to September 6th. The symptoms closely resemble those of other COVID variants, Weber said. Will the at-home COVID test detect the new variant? Yes. Studies have shown rapid antigen tests can detect a variety of COVID variants, including the XFG, according to iHealth Labs, a healthcare product manufacturer. A positive result on an at-home test can be considered a reliable indicator that you have COVID-19. If your first test comes back negative, the FDA suggests testing again after 48 hours to be sure. So that's all we have time for today. Sorry the time went so fast. This is Deborah Love, and I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. This program and its content is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Is there information you found helpful, or just let me know you're listening?